I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi again, Jason Klom here. Welcome to the Comedy on Vinyl miniseries, Family Albums, Episode 9, Dick Davey, Part 4. After spending so long looking for Dick Davey, then finding him, I kept my fingers crossed that I'd keep finding something new as I searched, and I was never disappointed. Stuff came in fits and starts, mostly newspaper clippings, and sometimes from listeners to this very show. One listener, in particular, Mark Skoback, has dug in places I wouldn't think of looking, and I have him to thank for adding some shows to my ongoing list of Davey's appearances that I wouldn't have had otherwise. A few months ago, as I headed off to Boise, this time to surprise my best friend Dan for his 40th birthday, I got an email from Sharon, Dick's niece. We've been communicating ever since we first talked for this show, and Sharon has been sending me photos and new information about her Uncle Dick ever since. This last email contained about 24 photos, going all the way back to when Dick was only 6 months old. I was in such a hurry to go to Boise, though, that when I first glanced at the email, I completely missed the most mind-blowing piece of this entire journey. Me, the guy who hosts the Comedy on Vinyl podcast, I was in such a rush. I missed 2 photos of record sleeves, inside of which were, you guessed it, records. One of them, at the center of which was a red Delta Recording Corp label, read, Dick Davey at the Bitter End, June 5th, 1962. The other, on a plain label, typed out were the words, Dick Davey, Farm Boy, followed by 13 ellipses. Singin' and talkin' and such. He's a big fan of ellipses. If you remember, the cover of his scrapbook reads, Presenting Dick Davey, ... Internally, for the sake of their safety, I debated whether or not these records should be shipped, but I turned to Firesign Theater's archivist Taylor Jessen to get his opinion. Thankfully, acetates from the early 60s, when packaged right, are stable enough to ship. Taylor took them, cleaned them up so I could have a rushed listen, and immediately after, I heard the strains of a song we can assume is entitled Evening Shade Arkansas.
Evening Shade Arkansas. Just a scrawny hill off Route 11, that's where it is. But I kind of like it there. I got a humpback mule, a plow, and a tater patch, eggs that are gonna hatch someday. Got my Lord above and a good girl to love me. I'm the richest man in the world. Thank you, Lord above, for smiling down on me. I'm richer now than any man has any right to be. I got a plow and I got a mule and a girl from Tennessee. New York is nice for a northern town, but it's evening shade for me. I got a humpback.
You can probably guess my reaction based on previous episodes, but I started to tear up. In fact, until I released that episode, which got it out of my system, I'd been re-singing that song basically every day to myself. It's not often you stumble upon hidden treasure. It's even less common that someone stumbles on it and then immediately shares it with you, out of kindness. Fortunately for us, Sharon chose to do just that. This week, I sit down with Taylor Jessen and discuss the contents of the 2 records, and we discuss the technical challenges with getting the digitizing right the first time, along with what future these tracks might have, outside of the Dick Davey archive. I'm here with Taylor Jessen. Hi, Taylor Jessen. How are you?
Hi, Jason Klom. I am swell.
You're basically, you're practically this podcast's co-host at this point because you've been on so many times and you're there to guide the show when you're there.
That's right. By the way, I'm not being paid enough, so we're going to have to stop this right now.
Fair.
Okay, if I'm the co-host, I can say that.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And you can say no because you're the co-host and we'll continue,
which is what we're doing right now. Well, you're one of those people who I think the people who listen to this show reticently would be like, why isn't that guy hosting? He actually knows some things. So, I try and diminish your knowledge on this podcast. So you come across as a real dum-dum.
I won't be hosting it because I don't ever want to host anything ever again in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have the talking problems.
Sure.
Which I've told you about.
Right. That's fine.
But that's fine.
I still want to hear some of your radio shows from back in Moscow.
You might enjoy this.
Yeah, I would. Taylor, why are we here? You know why we're here.
We're here because there are 2 records between us right now, and they're kind of exciting. They're acetates, And they got them hand-typed labels that always indicates that an acetate is a thing. Mm-hmm. That is like, this is the thing.
Yeah.
Kind of like a master tape is the recording of a thing. Mm-hmm. These are kind of unique. Well, then again, they might not be,
might
which
not
we
be,
can
right.
get into. But these are still, as of now, the only mm-hmm. existing copies of this rather interesting Dick Davey material.
So like a month ago, I got an email from Sharon, Dick Davey's niece, who people will remember from the first episode. And I will have teased at least part of a track in the last episode. So she sent me all these photos that are beautiful and amazing, and I missed in the photos that she also found these records. And then as I'm flipping through the photos later on, because I was in the middle of a trip or something, I'm like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
Oh.
There are two records here.
There's a thing I have to have or I will die.
Yeah. And I know specifically that they're not out there because one of them is from 1962 and the other one does not look like it's, you know, it might be a little bit later. We can discuss that.
These are definitely before the LPs.
Oh, yeah. And they're, like, the character, I wasn't sure if I was listening to, like, proto-Dick Davey or what, but I have some theories as to how he got here and then how he got to there. That
one
you hear
of
in the
them, the one that is an acetate that says Dick Davey at the Bitter End on June 5th, 1962, mm-hmm. he's definitely going on, he's full on board with the Dick Davey character.
Uh-huh.
And what's really interesting about this is that it's in front of a club audience, which yep. I have to assume is a mainly white audience.
Right, right.
But he's amplifying the fact that he's doing this character
yeah.
that is getting more and more Jewish.
Right.
He ends basically by singing Hava Nagila.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
The feeling in the room, correct me if you feel differently mm-hmm. about it, is that they are very, very slowly getting in on the joke.
I think so. And I think they are either Jewish or know enough Jews that this stuff is landing pretty well.
Yeah, it feels like a New York audience yeah. that knows enough about the kind of shows that they've been to before
mm-hmm.
that this guy is, they're getting what his act is slowly, mm-hmm. minute by minute.
Yeah.
When he gets to the Lone Ranger bit, it's it's pretty amazing.
It's great. It goes from like Bible Belt to Borscht Belt slowly is what it kind of becomes.
That's right.
The weird thing that's occurring to me, I think I emailed you this, was that we can talk about this later. I might even cut this out, but he had picked Evening Shade. Now, maybe it was in a paper somewhere where, hey, what a small town, because it's a town of 400 people still.
That's right.
And it becomes a sitcom in the 80s. So two pop culture people that, as far as I know, didn't know each other, don't know. I would like to do some digging.
Yeah, maybe you should do like a LexisNexis. Is there mm-hmm. like of newspaper headlines mm-hmm. in like 62
mm-hmm.
to see if Evening Shade was a thing?
That's a good question.
Or if it had a rep?
Because
there was somebody from Evening Shade?
He's rumored to have, well, I say rumored, his girlfriend / widow told me that he bought a plot of land in Evening Shade. He loved it so much. So I'm guessing he must have toured in and around there, because the mid-60s, later on he was doing, I don't know how early the civil rights marches were part of his thing, but he was definitely touring with civil rights musicians and people a ton. He was on the Mississippi, what was the name of it? It was a Mississippi tour of folk singers and stuff, like Len Chandler, who's the only person around still who performed with him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I don't know how early the civil rights stuff, which is one of the things I've been wanting to dig into. So I don't know. I really don't know why he picked Evening Shade. And if it...
Interesting.
Did he buy it after? Did he go to Evening Shade after he found out about it? But...
That's interesting. It'll depend on when he bought the property. If he went to Evening Shade and loved it and bought a property
yep.
and then went back to New York and started doing more shows,
mm-hmm.
I can understand if you discover a thing and you want to do right by it mm-hmm. karmically,
yeah.
you don't want to slag it off to the public at large.
Right.
Then I can see why he would put it in his act.
Mm-hmm.
But why Evening Shade in particular?
Yeah. Right.
We gotta find out.
Because it's one of those things where like, If you're from a bigger city, I feel like it's easier to mix in and be like, yeah, I'm from this slightly big city in the South, but no, I'm from this 400 person town in Arkansas. You could check my references if you wanted.
Yeah, because Nobody did. There's no Wikipedia. Nobody can check. Yeah. So you can say pretty much anything you want until you suddenly become popular. Mm-hmm. And then reporters start looking up on you, which obviously no one ever did.
No one did.
You, sir, had to do the lion's share of the research to find out who this person actually was. 40 years later. So 50 years later.
Still nobody knows.
So he had the cards pretty close to his chest this whole time.
So the Dick Davey, the Bitter End one is an actual club set. How long is this one? Like 12 or 14 minutes?
Like, say, something like that.
It's
like long enough that it could fit on one LP side.
Right. So it's just the only songs on there are the Evening Shade song
he does the Evening Shade song and then he closes with Havana Gay.
Right, which is fantastic.
And as you listen to it go by, you can hear tape edits.
Okay,
so
yeah,
this
you're saying
is
that.
From a tape somewhere.
Yes.
That hasn't turned up yet.
So I asked somebody about that. So the other song that's on Dick Davey, parentheses, Farm Boy, Singing and Talking and Such, not dated. This guy who I talked to, he's like, you know, it sounds like mid-60s. I think you're probably right, based on the guitar. That's all I got.
Yes,
all I
got. Sir. Gonna agree with you there.
I'm like, I was hoping it would be something earlier, but then I listened to it. I'm like, yep, you were right. That guitar and all that is distinctly. But he wrote a song called It Ain't Easy, co-wrote it with a gentleman named Herb Wasserman. I've been speaking with his son, Ron Wasserman. And he's like, yeah, my dad hung out with a bunch of comics. And he probably wasn't best friends with Dick Davey, but he's like, hey, let's just try and write something, see if it sticks. And that's all they did. Which is weird, because this is like, do you get the sense listening to specifically Evening Shade, but a bit of It Ain't Easy, that this is like, and I don't think it's stolen from this, but is there a moment in time where he creates Dick Davey and Jim Nabors creates Gomer Pyle? Because like they're very similar sounding.
That absolutely could be.
Jim Nabors' act Dick Davey's doing his comedy and his songs in the same character, whereas Jim Nabors is like, hi, you know, and then he, sings like a fucking angel.
Yeah.
But they're very similar accents, although Jim Nabors is actually from the South. So I don't know. I don't know where that came from.
It's
but,
a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You, was Jim Nabors' act like around at the same time that Dick was doing
the
this?
The earliest I found any records of Jim Nabors performing in Variety or elsewhere was 62. So I'm guessing it was early 60s. And then by 63, he was on the Andy Griffith Show.
Okay, so I'm seeing this as part of a big arrow from the East Coast major cities down to the South and back up again. It starts around 61, 62, 63 because the progressives and the liberals are going on the freedom marches and then coming back.
Right.
So that's definitely a thing, a thing that you do. I mean, it's a cross-pollination, but it's also people from the East Coast stealing whatever they can from where they go and then going back and making it a part of their act. If they're an actor, as Dick obviously was and Jim obviously was. So this is one of those things like when there was a giant war it's like with the French and whatever the fuck it was that the country across the Med that they were sort of colonizers of that Battle of Algiers.
Okay,
the whole cultural exchange happens. It can happen for terrible colonial reasons.
Sure,
but it happens regardless.
Yeah.
There's going to be an exchange of cultural information. So this is like Dick going on the freedom marches and then bringing back the things he liked or the things he found. And I don't know, Jim Nabors may have been thinking the same way. The point is you go, the media is in the East and the big cities, but it's getting all this new material from the South for the first time.
Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out, I feel like, okay, so there's another route to this, I feel like, and I want to get into it, but I don't, it's a way more conjecture than even anything we've just been throwing out there. So I want to talk a little bit about the process of getting these. So Sharon was kind enough and trusting it. Like at first I was like, you know what? No, I'll go up there physically and I'll take them from you eventually and we'll take our time. And then you convinced us both that like, no, it's fine. You can ship them. Just ship them well. And I'm like, Okay. All right.
It's something that I feel.
You understand why, right?
No, like, absolutely.
My brain is like, oh God, no. The one thing I've been looking for this whole time,
and here it comes, and it's broken.
Right.
We're
yeah.
fucked.
Yeah.
No. The absolutely. One of the things that I firmly believe is that if you ship something and you want it to survive, do not label it fragile.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Ship it so that it can't be broken
yeah.
under any circumstances.
Yeah.
And she did. So that was good. We got them. We have these two records, the one that we've already mentioned mm-hmm. and this second record that we're about to talk about, which mm-hmm. is
Dick Davey, Farm Boy, Singing and Talking and Such.
Which sounds like maybe it's side one and side two of 7-inch. What do you think? Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I wouldn't have thought that, but you saying that earlier made sense because if it's like, you were saying like it's, because it's two spoken bits and two songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so pick one for either, or one of each for either side. Makes
yeah, yeah.
sense because it's, what's the total length of that? 12 minutes, something?
Oh, it's like 7 minutes. Seven,
oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's yeah, yeah. perfect. Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't it be?
It would have fit on a 45, which makes me think that it was produced to be a 45
mm-hmm.
and nobody picked it up.
When I look through, because she also sent me scans of some letters that he was writing to his brother, and that's going to get more complicated too, because turns out there's a relationship between the two brothers that was deeper than anybody realized and than his brother remembers necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
He was literally trying to help him get club gigs in San Francisco. He's probably the reason he played the Hungry Eye at all.
Oh, wow.
Because I look in the notes, he's like, yeah, let me talk to some people I know. Who, and it's like, wait a minute, for real? And then he's like, I'd like to get you a copy of my record, but I've only got the one. So he only shopped. So we are lucky that whichever one he was sending, he obviously sent them both. He sent both of them to him at some mm-hmm. point. It's just crazy to me. And if he, let's say this one is 65, that means up until about the time right before he does the Apollo, him and his brother must have been okay, one assumes. So where was I going with that, Taylor? I know where I was going with that.
I don't know enough about the story to know when his relationship with his brother died.
And his brother doesn't. His brother doesn't either. Like his brother, most of what we discussed, because he's just older, has settled on, well, I didn't know much about his performing. I didn't know he did this. Didn't know he had two records. I think just some of that's just gone with the time. And some of the more strong emotions have stuck around, which are the stuff where they did end up separated and that kind of buried.
Yeah. And these things never have a start date and an end date.
No. It's family stuff. And now, you know, the next generation is like stuck trying to figure it out.
Right.
Or they weren't until I came along.
Right. Or they're just throwing it at you.
Mm-hmm.
Here,
mm-hmm.
Jason, here's this.
You figure this
out. Good luck.
So, yeah. So he sends his only records to his brother, trusting him. Hey, so these records probably got him into the Hungry Eye, is my guess. You know, that's all I can assume, is that they got him into the Hungry Eye.
Yeah, could be.
Oh, and that's where, to go back to Ron Wasserman, he was saying that, well, likely the masters, they didn't, he said the way they did it then is they just didn't do masters. They just recorded over it, put it on acetate, and just reuse the tape.
Wow.
Yeah. Based on what his father told him.
Oh my God.
So that's why the idea that there's a master out there is probably not likely. That it is now somebody else's master.
Okay.
You know, the last place that
now
tape
feeling,
ended.
Now yeah. I'm feeling glad that mm-hmm. I did at least what I consider to be a good transfer job of transferring these records.
Oh, yeah.
What you can't tell home listeners is that one of these records is... so the physical aspect of an acetate is that, as compared to a record, if you own a record and you or your family has probably owned a record at some point, mm-hmm. a record that is a record that you buy in a store is going to be polyvinyl chloride all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the trick with an acetate is that I think it's that on the outside, but on the inside, there is a disc made of metal.
Mm-hmm.
And the metal, if you hit it wrong, can become bent or impacted. So one of these records had to be transferred by yours truly with a little weight.
Oh, really?
On the stylus.
Oh, wow.
Because okay. it was hit at an angle that meant it was going to bounce. And when I played it back the first time, it did bounce.
Mm-hmm.
And but when I put a weight on it the second time, it was able to go through without skipping across
okay.
grooves.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my way of saying that acetates are are fragile on a number of ways. You don't want to play them too many times, mm-hmm. and you want to play them so that they don't skip. Mm-hmm. But regardless, I think I was able to digitize them both at 96K, so that's hopefully enough resolution that no one needs to play them again. If right. you do need to, mm-hmm. you can.
Sure.
But hopefully from what the digital information that we've got, you've got enough that with enough work, you could restore them.
And the loss with each play is considerable, right?
The loss with each play is considerable. You can almost hear it every time you play. There's an acetate in the Firesign Theater collection that I don't have anymore because we sent it to the Library of Congress, but it was a 1966 show with Phil Austin and three of his friends. They did a pilot episode mm-hmm. of what was supposed to be a sort of a goon show thing.
Uh-huh.
And it was called The Raspberry Show, R-A-Z-Z-B-E-R-R-Y.
Okay.
I could really only play that maybe two times. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it does begin to fall apart.
Is it the aspect of the actual record or the needle you have to use, the cartridge you have to use?
It's the actual object itself that you're trying to transfer.
Okay.
It's not meant to be permanent.
Okay.
It was meant to be something that the artist would take home and listen to and make some notes mm-hmm. and then go back in the next day and fix the things that they don't like
uh-huh.
and then thrown away.
Right.
In the world of artifacts that only exist on acetates, mm-hmm. that's why those are a problem.
Yeah. I mean, which is why, honestly, you need to email Jeff Abraham about that new heart thing he's got. Because we just dropped that on a regular old record player for once and just ran it into my fucking Zoom. Like, really. There's one other acetate coming down the pipe, possibly, if I can get this gentleman. I can't say anything about it, because if it never materializes, it never does.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally unrelated to any of this, but, like, every time I hear about it, I am like, okay, please, let's... Because even if it's unimportant, you know, because... You know, I don't know if this is important to me. Like, I shit myself.
It's okay not to obsess about these things mm-hmm. or obsess about these things.
Sure.
Or do both of those things.
Sure.
Really, all you can do is take the object itself mm-hmm. and, like, try and transfer it the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that you can do.
Yeah.
That's all that I did for these. Is
yeah.
that I tried to play them in such a way that the record wouldn't skip.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you can expect in some
yeah.
cases. And, then you do whatever electronic fixes you can
mm-hmm.
and you deal with it.
What were the ones that were like your biggest, because I know you know you're not able to do like what we would consider release ready cleanup, but for all of it, one of them sounds perfectly fine, but then the other one, which is the one that's got the biggest issues and why?
Oh, Christ,
I'm curious.
I can't remember.
But one of the two
is really
hissy and poppy, right? Sort of.
Yeah, they're both full of lots of scratches and pops.
Sure.
I can't remember which one of them has the I got hit aspect to
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. I'm not going to tell you.
If you can't tell
by listening,
yeah,
then forget it.
Who gives a shit? So how can you talk a little bit about how you go through and actually
edit
these
things? When I'm listening to a record and it's starting to bounce,
mm-hmm.
I mean it's simply as simple a physical thing as what I'm holding up now in front of the microphone is a very small pink eraser, mm-hmm. not even a whole pink eraser, a fragment of a pink eraser. It's just a thing with a certain amount of mass that you would then put on top of the stylus.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't even need to use this. You could use pennies, you could use dimes, anything that you could incrementally increase the weight on the stylus so that it doesn't bounce.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all you can do.
Yeah. What about that digital cleanup you do, though? Because we've never really talked about that on the
show. One of the great things everyone who wants to do their own digital cleanup should know about is a thing called iZotope.
Oh, yeah.
And iZotope is only for Mac right now,
mm-hmm.
but it's got a very, very good click and pop restoration that works at extremely low levels.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do it at very high levels so that it tries to fix absolutely everything,
mm-hmm.
but you can do it at very low levels so that it only does the very, very limited restoration. The less restoration you can do on a piece of original material, the better. Mm-hmm. So this has much better click and pop restoration than, say, Adobe Audition. Mm-hmm. And not to say anything against Adobe Audition, because I am a PC user mostly, and Adobe Audition is what I do most of my restoration in.
Okay.
But iZotope has really good plugins for click and pop.
Okay. All right. And what does, is it a matter of just, hey, let's run a thing, run an algorithm over the whole thing, or do you individually do it bit by bit?
Oh, I will. I'll do it in a giant block of, mm-hmm. I will click, please restore at lowest sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
I will wait 3 minutes and it will do it.
All right.
Then I'll take it into Adobe Audition and I will listen to it and I'll try and figure out if there's, you know, if there's big bumps underneath, mm-hmm. I can go in there in frequency view and I can remove bumps by frequency. Mm-hmm. And because I have really sensitive ears, I can then go in there and figure out what sounds wrong.
Uh-huh.
And moment by moment, fix things so that it sounds right.
Okay. That makes sense. Did you have, I mean, were there any big hiccups with this, either of these particular things, other than?
There are so many hiccups in uh-huh. there, I can barely even surprise. Uh-huh. As you, I was able to create a giant WAV file that basically has no clicks in it that are louder than the material in the mm-hmm, record mm-hmm, should have been. Mm-hmm. That's as far as I could go at some point.
Yeah,
There's a lot of noise in
yeah.
it.
I would. That was my fear. My real fear was unplayable, cracked surface, because I've seen those.
Oh yeah, you can get those. And all of these played all the way through, so that was a relief.
Mm-hmm. And I apologize to people listening because I'm all over the place because I'm very excited to actually physically see these in person. I've been waiting weeks to see these in person.
Please take them out of the sleeves.
I mean,
touch
I want
them.
To, I want to. There's just, I mean, I, and again, I've touched an acetate before, but not one of these. Not one of these. I'm assuming that, I don't know if that's his handwriting. I don't know enough about the bitter end. I was looking it up. If it's the same bitter end that's around now, then I could probably do a little bit more research.
It might be. I know there was a bitter end in the 70s because Procter & Bergman went there and performed.
Okay. Then I'm going to guess it's probably the same place. I mean, if it's in New York.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Delta Recording Corp. Man, this is so cool.
Nice red label mm-hmm. with typed information on it.
Whereas the other one, and I kind of love this about the other one, nothing on it. Nothing on it other than room to type the label up and slap
yeah,
it
blank
on
label and just a little typing on it saying what shape. The thing is.
This is in quite good shape, actually. I mean, like, based on, again, my expectation. I've seen them so chipped before in the past.
Yes. In terms of rescue, these were pretty easy.
What am I doing to put this in wrong? This does not like me right now. You son of a bitch.
Only you can help you at this point.
That's true. And I've done it. Look at me. I did it. Yeah, and I don't know. I'm trying to figure this out, like the evolution from one to the other. Let's assume Dick Davey at the bitter end, 1962, is four years before, like, singing and talking, Dick Davey Farm Boy.
Yeah, so is he maybe not trying to sell it to an LP at this point? He's just trying to... But he went so far as to go in there and make a tape and mm-hmm. edit it.
Yep.
So maybe... I don't know. Was this something he was using as a selling tool? Was he selling it? Was he sending copies to a lot of people?
He was definitely using it to get into clubs. I literally think these are his only two copies. I do think because in that letter it says, yeah, I've got the one and I'll send it to you when I can, but some club mm-hmm. has it right now. Which to me then means if anybody bothered to listen to him, then, you know, they might have gotten passed around and listened to by a few club owners. You know what I mean? Oh. So I guess we're even luckier that it survived, I guess.
Yeah, we're at this point we're lucky that it was even playable.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out what the character becomes and how. So I had a theory the other day. So he was part of a thing. I've been doing some digging. And thanks to the University of Wisconsin at Madison,
mm-hmm.
they have a very big archive. And the reason I asked them about this was one of the earliest things that Dick Davey is reported to have done in the 50s is travel around the Midwest, mostly Wisconsin, with this group called the 10-Gallon Trio.
Now, based off that, Western folk songs and comedy sketches in between. So, like, he started out as a musician. I know that. I don't know when the comedy started, but this is at least it's a place where he got to exercise that muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Not the place you'd typically think, because the story's usually, oh, you know, they were up in the Catskills performing with other Jewish performers for Jewish families, and then it became a thing, and it became a thing. No, he was touring, like, educational, doing educational stuff with this group of people.
Yeah, he went directly to the Midwest.
Yeah, and I'm wondering then if the character might have started there. I'm guessing, because he had to have been doing a Southern accent, is my guess. Because if you look at, like, the other promos with the original 10 Gallon Trio, which are none of the people he was involved with, they got cowboy hats on and shit. So there's no doubt that, like, they're just, hey, everybody, let's do this song. Like, it had to have been that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, as a touring guy, I don't have any personal experience in this, but I can tell you that if you're at the beginning of your career, mm-hmm. you take what you can get.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm wondering then. Again, he had some interest in folk music of some kind, and I think Americana was up. I mean, his whole thing is Americana, just different, very different specific aspects of Americana, Jewish Americana. Like, because if he was doing folk music but wasn't doing, you know, he wasn't a cantor, but he's doing folk music at Jewish places, I can't imagine it was just Jewish music necessarily either. I don't have any playlists, set lists. I wish I did. That would help. That would really help. But then I definitely know where the Southern thing at least started to come into his act. And I'm wondering if he just leaps off of that, goes and does his own thing, and then just settled into this character. I don't know.
What's most interesting to me is the question of whether he actually ever did his Southern character in the South.
Mm-hmm.
You would get weeded out right away.
You think so, right?
If you did not do that accent right.
Yeah, right.
If you didn't sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Not even in Alabama, in Tennessee or North Carolina, mm-hmm. you just get chased off the stage.
Right, yeah, because he's doing, it's what I would call a caricature. He might have thought he was being subtle, and to most of the East Coast audiences, that was...
Oh, totally.
You know, and also, they're doing, the people who intro him are doing a lot of the front loading for him.
Yes.
Hey, he's a foreign boy right from Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Although, isn't there a bit... on one of these where the manner of the introduction is hard to tell whether or not they're being a little facetious. I feel like it's a little possibly facetious. Oh, no, it might be on one of the albums, actually, because I used it to open the first Dick Davey episode where it's a little bit like, yeah, it's all like, hey, you know,
The guy at the bitter end is saying, this guy's from out of town, way out of town.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yep, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's always a little bit of that. So there's a little hint where maybe you're supposed to... But again, talk to people who had no idea he was from New York. People who lived near him in New York, hung out with him in New York. And outside of his act, he was still using the accent.
He was definitely able to sell it then.
And then
to people on the East Coast, I'm sure he was able to sell it easier than people who were closer to that part of the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Now it's another reason why.
Now we're getting totally into the world of the guy whose name I can't remember who played. I think part of his name was Cody. He was the star of the anti-littering PSAs in the 70s.
Okay.
Where he played an Indian.
Oh, yeah.
But he was an Italian from New York City.
That I didn't know.
And you split... when you do something like that as an actor, you split part of your soul away. And you decide whether or not you're going to... whether you karmically owe something to the group of people that you're attempting to imitate. Mm-hmm. And this guy was in for 100%. He wanted to accurately... He wanted to do right by the people that he was imitating. But he was not a Native American.
Right.
So
that's fascinating.
That's part of the equation when you decide to play somebody.
Yeah. But to commit to the point, and I'm just trying to figure, he was obviously very proud of the interview in the book that he ended up doing, his one big interview, you know, and like to the point where when he met Lillian, his girlfriend, he's like, you know, they just interviewed me for this book. Like, that's part of his pickup, I think. It was like, hey, you can find... And she's like, all right, well, I'm going to check. You know, I'm going to go to a bookstore and see if this is real, right? And so she did. She's like, oh, okay, that's cool. But in the book, the guy says you can still hear a bit of the twang. And like, is he convinced of that? Because, but I don't know, because he also tells him, like, I don't know. It's very confusing. I'll never know. I'll never be able to sit Dick Davey down.
That's true. You always want to get as much as you can from the person who's doing the act. Dick sounds like, I mean, you've done research on Dick enough to the point where you know that he was an actor in films.
Yeah.
So he was an actor in mm-hmm. full quotes. And was he SAG-AFTRA or?
That I don't know because he never, I mean, there's no record that he had a speaking part in anything. However, he did so much like Merv Griffin and stuff at that point. If you had, I would assume you'd have to be union. Maybe not though. Maybe not talk shows.
Yeah.
Even if you're a performer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could probably be non-union and get it. That's probably how they got away with those shows being so cheap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he was committed. He was doing this guy as a character, and he mm-hmm. was a character actor. So he was out there as a professional in the world. It absolutely feels like this is stuff that he finessed to a degree mm-hmm. that he wanted it to be released. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's just a question of restoration and finding the right avenue to put it out. It'll be all good mid-60s shtick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the songs are well produced enough. I mean, thank you, Horn. My thing was, I was like, I just want to hear him sing after I realized the ones that singing, and like, I don't even know if the song's good, but it brought tears to my eyes hearing it. So I'm like, I finally get to hear this guy sing.
Yeah,
you know, because there's a mix of like, he's got a beautiful voice.
It's like a studio version. There's no audience. Great.
Yeah, it's a lot less rough sounding than the studio the audience version. It's a little rough.
Okay, so wait a minute. Gotta stop you for a second. Please. Does he actually sing the? Because I can't remember. Does mm-hmm. he sing the song about his hometown on either of the albums?
On the Evening Shade one. On both, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he does.
Yeah, okay. There's a studio version and the live version.
So this is the only known studio version
mm-hmm. of that. Cool. Yeah, which is kind of great. Yeah. I mean, and it is weird to have him do studio. I never can quite figure out what the studio version of the stand-up bit is about, because that's what that Bob Newhart thing was that we talked about previously. We think it might have been an advertising thing that he was doing Paul Revere, but...
That's right.
But studio version of a bit, even if it's this homespun Mark Twain kind of shit, like, I don't get it.
It just feels, like it's supposed to be one side of a, all that I can think is that particular bit is supposed to be two sides of a 45.
Yeah. But even as a studio thing of a, I guess it's one of those, it's like, it might be a thinker in the room anyway, so it might not get any laughs, so let's just make it as cute and like clever sounding as possible, I guess, maybe.
Well, it's the whole world of mid-60s novelty singles.
Yeah,
you do what you can, and you think, oh, I'm a guy, I have an act, mm-hmm. let me put this out there, see if it hits, I know this character, and if there's a demand for it, I can do more stuff.
Yeah.
So this was something he was probably trying to aim mm-hmm. at a label of which we know nothing.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that circulated in interviewing his niece and interviewing his widow where, and you have to try and separate fact from fiction, which is impossible now because this is now third hand that I'm getting this. So he's telling them this.
Good luck, Jason Plum. Good luck.
Well, and all I can do is when somebody tells me, he told me that he might have been a Marlboro man, I just email the archives to Marlboro and hope they get back to me. They haven't. Mm-hmm. I want to find out, because I found a few. I'm like, that could be him, but it's probably not. But, like, doesn't mean he didn't pose. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Doesn't mean he didn't audition.
It's all you can do.
But I also know that he said that he co-starred these scenes with Edwin when he's in the background with a fucking sombrero on his head looking like a goofball. It's adorable, and it's some shit that I would pull. And he's in the whole scene. But... You know, which is another reason I'm so charmed. I'm like, how can I not be?
How can you not like a guy who's a comic and who does extra work?
Yeah, it's great.
You're on board right away.
I need to find out who was, because Central Casting existed then. I want to find, they probably don't have records, but I want to know what else he could have been in.
Interesting.
You know, and if he got, and if he was getting paid under the name Dick Davey or Richard Davey, he might have actually used that name with Central too. I don't know.
Okay, so here's a question. Do you know anything about why he stopped?
Yes. Yeah. The rumor, rumor. He told the interview originally that it was MLK.
That's right. You did tell me that.
And that has been corroborated by enough people that it's like, oh, that clearly seems to be the issue.
Yeah.
He did still do stuff. He did still do stand-up for a while, and he did still open for some acts and stuff, and like he did an auction for a school in 1970 where he was MC. So he still did some stuff here and there, and... clearly performed for his students, which is another reason I need to know. I've been talking with the New York Department of Education for months mm-hmm. to find out what school he taught at, because mm-hmm. we're not sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so but that's why he stopped and just went back to doing school stuff, because he knew he could make a difference. I mean, it's in Harlem, you know. He clearly had
he had to do something. This is perfectly understandable. I mean, yep. This is what Tom Lehrer did with his career.
Yeah, 100%.
He decided that there was only so much horror that he could deal with as a maker of satirical songs, and he just went to teaching.
Yeah.
And he continued teaching.
Yeah. And I mean, there's only, you will never be able to measure and therefore never be able to prove if comedy does any good. You know, we'd all love to think that, and it makes us laugh and it brings
Where
us joy.
Where is the data on comedy but enjoyment and pleasure?
There's no data on what it does to make things better in an obvious way. Whereas teaching, although you don't get paid shit to do it, at least you're like, I will do my damnedest. I have this clay. I will fucking work it as hard as I can to make sure these kids succeed. Mm-hmm. So you've got something in front of you, you know? You probably get as many letters from a student saying, hey, thank you, you changed my life, as you do from a person saying, hey, I remember I saw you do this joke about, you know, something that's real funny. Like, you know, which is, you know, you pick which is of more value to you. And you,
yep. Yeah, you do.
And do that. And so I respect that, obviously. I just wish I knew more. And again, I don't know what else he didn't hold on to anything. Obviously, this he didn't care enough about to take back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, if this one is from 64 or 65 or, you know, yeah, then, you know, next year after that, he's at the Apollo. He doesn't need these anymore, as far as he knows.
That's right.
And he's opening for everybody. He's opening for, I can't name them all, the Four Tops and all these. I found something where he fucking opened for Led Zeppelin, or he was there. Jesus. Like, he's performing for, it was either before Led Zeppelin or Robert Plant, or like one of them doing some solo shit, but randomly found it on a Led Zeppelin website. Where they listed, I'm like, what the fuck? So he was opening for these acts that don't make any sense. I mean, he opened for Ike and Tina Turner at the Apollo, so I mean, come on. So
he had the two albums on Columbia, and then Columbia, I guess, at some point informed him that they weren't interested anymore.
One assumes.
One would have to assume. And then
Didn't have a contract more than two albums, and like by 68, he was done.
Yeah.
And he wasn't
so performing. By 68, his career is sort of, he's got enough momentum that he can keep going a little bit, but he doesn't have a record contract.
Right.
So he's going on his own word of mouth.
I guess so. That's all I can guess is like, you know, hey, I've got these records out. You might've heard I opened at the Apollo, you know, did gangbusters there. Yeah. I don't know. And
I totally understand if the impetus for him to keep going died after Martin Luther King died, because something like that, it's like, why the fuck even keep going? I can't even, it's getting easier for Americans to imagine what it's like to live in a 50% racist society. Mm-hmm. I bet nobody listening to this can imagine why. but there's a point at which you weigh the scales and you decide, is there any point to going on with what I was doing? And no, I think I'll just do this other thing.
Yeah. And it's kind of gutsy too, because he didn't end it in like a, oh, I regret everything I did. Obviously he's like, I tried my fucking hardest and I got two records under my belt. If I had two records under my belt released by a major label, I'd be like, all right, I'm good. Like that was cool. That was fun. I made all of the Apollo laugh, you know? I mean, that's phenomenal. And it's all good stuff. Like it's stuff to me that it's great that it survives, but it's also great that it is, risk-taking race humor by a white man that is not, here's the fun differences between our races, go fuck yourself. It's very good, like, he does the smart thing where he plays the bumpkin, he plays the idiot, and then gets to explore in these fun ways. I don't know. This is all stuff I've talked about on the show, but I'm enjoying the conversation part of it. I don't know. And that's one of the reasons why I'm like, I've continued to stick with it. You know, he hasn't turned out to be a serial killer.
Not yet.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, there's. I'm sure you're going to find a lot more interesting gold down in that mine shaft.
I hope so. The big thing right now is students.
Mm-hmm.
Coworkers are probably not a thing, but students, you know, students would be in their 60s now, right? So 60s and 50s. I would love to get a hold of them. And then people who performed with them who are dropping off. It's just happening. So I need to, like, find out. But there are like big people who he would have performed with who might not remember at all. But I need to dig. Then the dumb thing is like, you get these like things like that where it's like, oh, right, I should look up people he performed with because they might be dropping off. And like, you don't think of like some very obvious places you should be digging. sometimes. I look in the more obscure places like an idiot. And then hope that records show up. And then magically, see, this is what happens, Taylor.
They do.
Is that the fairies have delivered upon me two records. You know, these beautiful comedy fairies have delivered to me these two weird, very weird, obscure records that maybe someone will care about. Let's see. I hope to get something, to make something happen about it.
The comedy fairies have delivered to me 11 boxes of shit, which I'm going to show you in a few minutes, which we don't have to talk about in this podcast because it'll kill you
at
all.
At some point, it's going to have to happen. What we'll have to do is have Jim Turner come back on, and you.
Absolutely.
And we're going to have to basically start doing what we've been doing with Fire Sign, but with you two.
That's a good idea.
That would be, because is he the only Ducks guy here?
No. I can't remember. No, there are two of them in L.A.
Oh, okay.
Leon Martel is also in L.A., and I've talked to him via email, but there are one car family and they live in the West Valley. Mm-hmm. And I haven't actually met him yet, but
okay.
I trust that I will at some point. Yeah, that's a good idea. We won't have a lot of albums to talk about because they only did two,
right? That's fine, that's quick,
but that's fine.
Well, what we'll do is we'll do one album, other album, and then here's some weird shit in the archive to talk about.
Absolutely,
because it'll get people interested in it, you know, because there's literally thousands of tracks of stuff that you're trying to get out there.
Yes.
Again, this probably won't end up in the episode either. I'm trying to think. So yeah, I think the 10-gallon trio is one thing that might... all those people are dead. No doubt about it.
Oh, dear.
There's no doubt in my mind. These people are all in their early 90s. Like, I'm lucky that Rusty Warren's still around. I feel like I need to put a thing in here, actually.
It's true, but don't feel like you shouldn't look and see if they're all dead, because...
I've been digging.
Yeah.
And at least, like, hey... Your father did this. Is it possible he was that, your father? Because you don't know. These names are so...
Exactly.
Kind of...
Exactly.
And then everything that the University of Wisconsin sent me about the 10-gallon trio was about three entirely different people. So I think they started it, and it was probably like educational things, just rotating. It's like,
mm-hmm.
up
mm-hmm.
with people. Let's
yeah, yeah.
This guy died. You know, this guy committed suicide. Mm-hmm.
It's the... What was... I had an engineer friend, Drew Daniels, and he was in the... there was a folk band with at least 12 people in it.
Oh my God.
In the 60s.
Okay.
That had a huge rotating list of people that were in it. It's exactly like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are 12 people. Oh, these six have gone away.
Yeah, yeah.
No problem. We've got six more. And now we have one guy to play the bass and he's moved on. Yeah, no problem. Well, mm-hmm. there were probably 200 different people who were in the whatever this group was,
right.
Whose name I can't remember.
The other thing is, like, there might be a person, like, a big name. Let's say the person we were talking about earlier comes on the podcast, and I'm like, and, like, Dick Davey comes up. He might be a big fan. You don't know, because
mm-hmm.
these people are, like us, usually, like, big fans of shit. But if they don't have anybody to talk with about it, then it's just lays in the back of their filing
mm-hmm.
cabinet until somebody brings it up. So
yep.
I don't know who to ask. And now think I should probably ask everybody over the age of 60 if they've heard of him.
Everybody,
you know?
Over the age of 60 who was a stand-up in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there are probably people who must have seen him. I mean, the dude, one of my favorite things in that book, in that interview, is how he shits on how much he didn't like Dylan at the beginning. Like, he thought Dylan was a crappy guitar player or whatever he said. And I thought that was ballsy to say in the 70s. I thought
that
was great.
That's pretty awesome.
So he probably saw Bob Dylan. There's a half chance of Bob Dylan saw him and might... I don't know how much Bob Dylan remembers of anything, but...
It's worth finding out.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I don't know what his act was like. I don't know how it developed. Because early stuff, too, he's like, I've got, you know, tie in a suit and, like, I don't know what kind of music he was doing. I don't know if it was this. I don't know if some Smothers Brothers shit.
It's really hard to tell. It's this whole sui generis act of that he put together himself. He created this character
mm-hmm.
based on what the people in New York City, metropolitan,
yeah.
would have believed as a Southern character,
mm-hmm.
gave him a bunch of backstory and some songs,
mm-hmm.
and really worked like hell on putting together an act.
Yeah.
And... there was a huge amount of work that went into that, and there's going to be little corners of it that are going to be popping up everywhere.
And I want to know if this is, again, assuming this one is 65, when does the music go away? He just must have been like, this isn't working. Like, that song wasn't a hit. I'm just going to do the comedy. Like, I didn't, now that I think about it, yeah, you would have thought the music would have gone sooner if his first album has no music on it, and his second album obviously has no music on it. You would think Like, by even by 62, he might have not been thinking about the music, but this is a 65-ish is a produced music single. I don't get it. I don't get it, and I don't know when he stopped, because he didn't stop playing music in his life, but at some point that act didn't support that as an idea anymore.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Because, like, he's clearly trying to make a pop single with The One, like a weird, a novelty pop single.
Yeah.
They're both novelty, but, like, one's a poppy, like,
yeah,
kind of, like, pop country, weird, fucking, jankly thing. That's not a word, jankly. But you know what I'm saying?
No,
so I don't know. I just don't know when it drops off. And these are questions I don't know if they'll ever be answered. People, if you're out there, nobody's listening. Listen, fuck it.
Call him at area code 208.
557-3524.
And tell him what your theories are. Tell him in detail.
Detail. I do want to thank you, though, Taylor, before we finish this, because you first of all, you do a lot of work, and I feel very bad that I can just be like, when somebody says something like this exists, I'm like, yeah, no, I can take care of it, which is code for Taylor's going to do hours of work for me for free.
Oh my God. No, the shit like this, I just want little treasures like this to fall on me like so much pixie dust.
Mm-hmm,
It really is. Every single one of these little... I mean, across the room from me, you viewers cannot see, there are two boxes, two of probably 20 boxes of original reels from the Duxbury Mystery Theater. Every single one of those things is going to potentially be something that has on it that even the guys in the group can't remember. And enough of these things have gone by that I have played for the members of the group that they couldn't remember that they went, oh my God, what is that? That you feel completely justified in the fact that you just took the amount of time to transfer it and make them laugh. And all of these things are like that. If there's a potential laugh in something, are you kidding? I'll stop whatever I'm doing.
Yeah, right.
And just do it.
Well, and I'm glad, too, that you got a chance to listen through to these, too, because you pointed out a few things to me I wouldn't have necessarily picked up on, or I also realized that I was so excited about these that I didn't listen to all of them. At first, I was just like, oh, that song's so pretty. Oh, God, I have other things to do because things are insane. And some of that other things involved more research about Dick Davey. I could have just listened to them as I was researching, but Taylor, this is not how my brain works. I move on too fast, even for things that I love, that I absolutely love.
Everything that one obsesses about is not just a thing to enjoy. It is an obsessional thing that involves hours of research.
Yeah.
90% of all obsessional enjoyment is looking shit up.
Yeah.
The other 10% is listening to the thing.
I there's obviously, and there's a big part of this, if we want to deal with the psychological aspect of it, like two big things. Number one, I'm a comedian and have been for years. Nobody knows who I am. That's fine. That's fine. So there is definitely the, like, let me slightly lift this other person who had more of a profile. This guy who, did I tell you about the autobiography or the biography that was written about his father?
Oh boy, I can't.
His father, Isidore B. Hoffman, very big rabbi. His father is a rabbi. One of the things people were saying, well, he didn't continue being a rabbi, so they thought that might have been one of the reasons. Long story short, Isidore's wife, when he passed away, which was not Richard's mother, she paid to have a biography written about him. And in it, towards the end of the first chapter, it just a little sum up, and it says, because, you know, Richard had a brother, Daniel, who I spoke with. And so Isidore also has two sons, Daniel and Robert. Got Richard's name. Called him Robert in his father's only biography. And I'm just like, I want to do right by him just for that. Like, I'm offended that that exists. I'm just like, how piss poor of a researcher do you... The one famous one, too. Like, the one semi-famous one, and he got the name wrong. Robert. That's...
Yeah.
Fact check, people. It's always important. There's that, and then there's the digging I've been doing because, like, you know, it's this weird mystery of my friend dying, and I think I just started doing this because I'm like, I need something I can maybe solve, you know? Something that's more, maybe less morbid, because I know the guy's dead already, you know?
No, that's absolutely reasonable. Part of the thing that happens when you adopt a comedy group, which you and I have both done, a comedy individual or a comedy group, is that you want to dig in there and you want to figure out what was undone, what that still needs to be done, and then do that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's, I mean, if it's never ending, that's okay with me. I never expected this. Mm-hmm. I don't expect anything more. I feel like this is probably the peak of what I will find. But if I find something else, therefore, I will be pleasantly surprised.
I'm quite sure that more will turn up.
I hope.
So just with what of course is going to happen is that those what turns up is going to have five little arrows attached to it, and those will all point to other research projects that find yourself having to do.
Oh yeah, no, I mean
that's the horrible life that we have chosen.
It
for
made
ourselves.
Me spend a whole day on the 10-gallon trio, and I didn't need that. Mm-hmm. I just was hoping it would lead somewhere, and
had to anyway.
Yeah. Found some guy's website about playbills from this very small town in Wisconsin, and one of the people who was in the 10-gallon trio was on this in this playbill. And I'm like, I should look up this guy's daughter. And I'm like, I should go look. No. There ended up being some alleyway that was pointless and I didn't need, because again, I'm trying to fill some hole in my life. Hi guys.
We can't stop.
Yeah, very much so. Well, Taylor, again, thank you for this.
My pleasure.
Thank you for getting me interested in archiving, because that's important, realizing that was the thing I was obsessed with the whole time.
My pleasure and my apologies. Mm-hmm. There's no way to backtrack on this track that you've gone down. It's a slide.
Yeah.
It's not a road. It's a slide.
What's next for Dick Davey? For the first time since he retired over 50 years ago, we can confidently ask that question, knowing there's the possibility for something new on the horizon. In the meantime, I continue my research, looking for fellow teachers and students of Richard David Hoffman, Dick's real name. I'm also hoping to find people who were at civil rights rallies with Dick, or who traveled with the Mississippi Caravan of Music as part of the Freedom Summer of 1964, which Dick was a part of. Anyone who opened for him, performed with him, saw him perform, you can email me at jason@comedyonvinyl.com. Also, if you find audio or footage of Dick that I might not have heard or seen, and there's plenty out there, from the early Merv Griffin Show days to the Jewish Home Show to Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which he won, to Charlie Weaver's Home Show starring Cliff Arquette. Some may still exist, some may not, but if you can help me source these clips, you'll have my unending appreciation and a credit on Dick's archive site for your help. I'll try and send you a movie or something too. Each clip and each story adds to the oral history of Dick's life and career, and I'll share what I find here and at comedyarchive.org. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned. Keep your eyes out for history. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs, and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years.